Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Dear Daughter is the award-winning podcast from the BBC World Service, full of thoughtful letters of advice, personal stories, and life lessons for daughters everywhere. Search for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the documentary The Cultural Frontline from the BBC World Service. Back in 2012, parts of New York City were devastated by floods. People died. The city came to a standstill, including the stock exchange, and the damage cost almost $20 billion.
I think all of us obviously have been shocked by the force of Mother Nature as we watch it on television. At the same time, we've also seen nurses at NYU Hospital carrying fragile newborns to safety. We've seen incredibly brave firefighters in Queens, waist deep in water, battling infernos and rescuing people in boats.
I'm Razia Iqbal, and today we're going to meet the Danish architect Bjarke Ingels, who is responsible for the Manhattan Flood Project, designed to tackle the impact of climate change.
In the case of a storm warning, this whole thing, it looks like something from Star Wars. This giant element actually rolls along these tracks and hits the kind of rounded wall on the other side, and it creates a tight seal so that if the entire East River comes up, as it did with Sandy, it's going to stay on the water side and not come into the city side.
I moved to New York a few months ago, and the apartment I live in, I chose precisely because of the panorama it gives me. I get to see Central Park on the east side. I get to see the Empire State Building. And as I move around to the west of New York, there are two buildings that are fairly new in this city, both of them designed by Bjarke Ingels. One's called The Spiral, and the other is called Via 57, which overlooks the Hudson River and is like a knife slashing its way through the Hell's Kitchen area. And here we are, just six blocks away from my apartment, and I'm standing in front of Via 57. It's an entrance to Manhattan via 57th Street. It's a funny thing, you think that New York will never surprise you in terms of its skyscrapers, and then a building like this rises up, and it's not a skyscraper, it's tall, but it's a triangle. So how does that work as a residential building?
Thank you.
We're in the courtyard now. It's like a kind of oasis of green, even though it's winter and the trees are bare. There's still quite a lot of green. It's funny, you see a kind of triangle of sky as well as the triangle of the courtyard. And as you get to the end of the courtyard, it's like the building just divides. It is one edge of the pyramid. And you get the most spectacular view of the Hudson River and New Jersey on the other side. Wow. Although I can see the traffic on the highway and hear it, obviously, there is something so magical, even on a grey day like today, of emerging out of glass and metal and concrete and just seeing a stretch of water. You live in this building. How long have you been here?
3.5 years now.
Why did you want to live here?
Great amenities, great apartment size, and just an awesome view of the city. It stands out in the skyline. That's also a big reason to live here. And everybody knows this building around here, for sure.
And do you know who designed it?
I've looked it up, and I've seen who designs it, but I cannot remember the name. I have to.
Thank you very much for talking to us. We're just getting into a taxi now to go downtown. We'd like to go to East 23rd Street, Stuyvesant Cove Park. I'm from the BBC,
yeah.
And we're just recording a programme about the city,
yeah.
About a particular architect. You were talking to me. Sorry?
Frank Gehry?
No, not Frank Gehry. That's so interesting that you know Frank Gehry's work. So you're interested in buildings?
Oh, yeah.
Well, we got into the right taxi. We've come out of the taxi now, and you can hear the ubiquitous sirens of New York. Sometimes I think the entire city is in peril.
We've come to FDR Drive North. It's the part of the city where all of these flood defences are being built. Let's see what's going on.
Hi, I'm Razia Iqbal.
Hi, Bjarke Ingels.
Hi, Jeremy Siegel.
Great to meet you on what feels like a really quite grim grey day, and we're by the river on the edge of Manhattan. So Bjarke, tell me exactly where we are and what we can see.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we're looking at across the East River at Queens, and I think behind us you can hear the Franklin D. Roosevelt Elevated Highway, and we are in the sort of northern part of what we've nicknamed the Dry Line, which is essentially, if you imagine, the high line that's going to keep Manhattan dry when the next Hurricane Sandy comes.
First of all, tell me about the idea of trying to make this flood-proof and what we will see when it's finished.
Right after Hurricane Sandy came, there is a lot of public housing all along the east side of Manhattan, and they got it worse than anyone else. We got invited as part of the Obama Hurricane Sandy Recovery Fund to make a proposal for how to keep Manhattan dry the next time Hurricane Sandy comes. And we came with this idea of imagining a kind of chameleon of public space all along the waterfront of Lower Manhattan. We called it the Big U. And this chameleon would change depending on what kind of urban landscape it passed by. And we sort of submitted an idea where Jeremy sort of reached out to every single community board, every single public housing project, and every interest organization we could find that had a home along the waterfront of Manhattan. And we reached out to them and said, this needed to happen. A lot of hard engineering needed to take place. If they were interested in engaging with us in co-designing what their new waterfront would look like, so that not only would the waterfront become resilient, but it could also become more accessible and more enjoyable. To withstand the storm surge, you need a certain elevation of flood protection, but we wanted to have all the streets. When you live here and you look down the street, you can always see the river. In general, you'll see like a green landscape that, of course, is going to be eventually a lot greener than when it's just newly planted. You can see the flood wall is made in this kind of woven texture. Every wrinkle is at every feet. So it also becomes an indication of how high the water could come. And then you have these massive floodgates that are tucked into the landscaping. This giant element actually rolls along these tracks and hits the kind of rounded wall on the other side. And it creates a tight seal.
So had we been here when Hurricane Sandy happened, and we were on this side of the flood gate,
we would be drenched and very cold, so it would be much smarter to stay on the other side. Then essentially, as the dry line moves down, it takes on much more space. And there it really becomes like grand parks with sports fields and bigger rolling hills. But then we're also creating a series of pedestrian bridges so that the people on the other side of the FDR will always have as good access as possible to enjoy their riverfront.
Jeremy, let's talk about the engagement with the communities, which is an unusual thing to have to do if you're just making a building, because if you're making a building, you get the permission and you get on with it, you contract the people to do it. So how did this work? Because clearly there were some issues with some of the people in the local communities.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of competing interests and needs and desires along the waterfront and in New York City. For us coming into this, you know, we primarily were practicing design prior, so this was really kind of throwing us into the fire of community engagement and political engagment.
And does
all of Jeremy's hair was black when he started this podcast.
That's true.
Since this is radio, it's no longer only black.
But I wonder about that. I want to ask a question of both of you, because in the end, this is really about politics too, right? I mean, you have to be a negotiator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, you know, I think as a designer, it's also having a kind of balance of strength of ideas and confidence in your technical expertise, but also a kind of humility and an openness to listening. And being able to take multiple viewpoints, multiple competing demands,
and find a middle way through them. And it's taken about 10 years, but we've arrived at a $1.5 billion capital project that's about, it's almost halfway done now.
Were you here when it happened?
I was actually in Copenhagen
I was actually living in Lower Manhattan at the time.
Exactly where I was. We lost power, like all of Lower Manhattan, but the water didn't quite reach my doorstep.
Give me a sense of what it felt like to be in the kind of eye of the storm.
No, it was kind of interesting. Like one of my good friends, a film director, Martin Detour, came to, because he had an idea that I was in a safer zone than him. And then because he was a film director, at some point there was a kind of, felt like the eye of the storm. So he insisted we go out and see. There was like these this advertising for MoMA along the street on these kind of printed aluminum sheets. And one of them ripped off and came flying like a frisbee, probably a few feet over our heads. But it felt like basically a guillotine. And that's when I called in and said, I have documented this this incident enough. I'm seeking safety. I like to have my head on my shoulders. But essentially the real aftermath for us was really the next 2 weeks, where being without power in an urban area is incredibly unpractical. Yeah, no, I mean, also, like, I think actually it was this power plant that blew up.
Yeah.
And we saw that. You saw this kind of incredible flash on the night sky. It definitely felt like one of the great cities of Earth sort of disintegrating over a course of 24 hours. But then also, like, just to the kind of public participation that Jeremy was talking about, like, I think one of the first things we noticed when we reached out to the different community groups was the general distrust. Yes. That anyone would genuinely have their interests at heart. It's because their experience, their life experience, is that it's not always good what happens, right? And then I think secondly, I was surprised that a lot of the representatives of the community groups were afraid that we might end up making their neighborhood too nice. And then maybe like some more affluent people would move here, and then maybe the prices in the grocery store would go up, and like making the neighborhood too desirable.
So are we going to walk? Which way are we driving? Are we
We're driving down
south.
Yeah.
Down south.
Yeah. Jeremy can be speeding drive-by commentary as we...
So now the road is taking us along the river.
Yep. So the road and the park were built in the 1930s on landfill.
This was all reclaimed land, right?
That's right. That's right. If you look at the big U, it's actually really the outline of all of the landfill that the Dutch began in the 17th century and that the British continued, sort of concentrating land towards the harbor. And that land was often used for industry, and then industrial often turned over to public housing. So you kind of have this pattern of vulnerability for public housing, which is why this project was really one of the first to get funded.
And we are just going under the Williamsburg Bridge now.
That's right. And you can see here to our left, that's the finished height of the park.
And the bridge we're going under now?
That is the Manhattan Bridge. And then in front of us is the Brooklyn Bridge.
Must be a thrill to be able to build skyscrapers in Manhattan, though, right?
No, I know, actually, like, when we came here the first time and we ended up designing what became the court scraper, the Via 57, which is essentially a hybrid between a European courtyard building and an American skyscraper. First, I was a little bit sort of challenged by the fact that I finally got to sort of contribute to the skyline of the cradle of the skyscraper, and we couldn't really do a skyscraper. So when we finished the spiral, I finally got that out of my system.
You found minor fame as an actor in Game of Thrones. How did that come about?
I think, first of all, minor fame and actor are very strong terms in this context. I became good friends with Nicolai Coster-Waldau, who plays Jaime Lannister. I love the books. I love the show. I got to meet Dan and David also, the showrunners. We had dinner. They said we built basically half of King's Landing in Ireland. You should come and see it before we blow it up, and we'll put you in a costume. And it was kind of funny, when they were showing us around, they were so excited. There was so much real construction in this particular part of it. So they actually rebuilt significant streets of Dubrovnik. But then they also realized that, I guess maybe to you, this is actually a small construction, because of course, for us filmmakers, it's huge. But then I got to participate in the scene where Khaleesi finally is corrupted by power. I was quite excited, and we were running towards the camera, like a whole scene with like sort of thousands and extras running straight past the camera. And then they said, okay, that was all great, try to not smile. Like someone was smiling a lot, and you have to be full of fear. There's a dragon coming and an army. There was no mention of anyone specific, but I really felt that was probably
that
for
was
me.
You.
That was me. So I probably cost that show like at least a few thousand bucks in retakes.
Well, we've arrived, so let's go into your office.
All done for today?
Yes. Thank you so much.
What stories and advice would you like to share with daughters everywhere?
And what are different countries around the world getting right in order for women to live well and succeed?
Where to Be a Woman is the brand new podcast exploring in which countries women are living their best lives and what the rest of the world could learn from them.
And my award-winning podcast, Dear Daughter, is back for a new season. Join me, Namulanta Kombo, as I update my handbook to life for daughters everywhere.
Search for Where to Be a Woman
and Dear Daughter
wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hallo, hier sind Julia und Chris vom Podcast Drinnies. Wir machen nicht nur einen Comedy-Podcast, sondern gehen auch leidenschaftlich gerne nicht zu Stoßzeiten in den Supermarkt. Ehrlich gesagt bleibe ich am liebsten ganz zu Hause und ziehe nur eine Hose an, wenn es klingelt. Wenn es euch auch so geht, dann ist HelloFresh genau das Richtige für euch. Der Kochbox-Lieferservice bringt euch frische, abwechslungsreiche Gerichte direkt vor die Haustür, die ihr im Handumdrehen selbst zubereiten könnt.
Und mit dem Code LECKER24 könnt ihr jetzt richtig sparen. In Deutschland bis zu 120 Euro, in Österreich bis zu 130 Euro und in der Schweiz bis zu 140 Franken. Also Code LECKER24 eingeben und sparen.
PS, der panierte Portobello-Pilz mit Sweet Chili Ketchup ist sehr gut.
You're listening to the documentary The Cultural Frontline from the BBC World Service. I'm Razia Iqbal, and in this episode, we're talking to the architect Bjarke Ingels.
We're a few people. Thank you.
And we're now inside your Manhattan office, which is vast. This kind of, describe it to me, it's like a massive warehouse industrial space.
We were actually trying to find the largest possible floor plate we could find on a single level. It's essentially a city block in Dumbo,
right,
down under Manhattan Bridge overpass, Dumbo, you know, framed by the Manhattan Bridge to one side and the Brooklyn Bridge to the other side. You can see, like, we're standing here surrounded by all kinds of architectural models, but one of the models is definitely a lot longer than all the other models, which is the dry line.
The initial project was one thing, and it has mutated and morphed into what we're talking about now. This part, the East River Park, was the bit where I think local residents were most concerned about the big changes that were going to happen. How did you navigate that?
I think it is unavoidable when you are messing with the, you know, let's call it 10 miles of waterfront of one of the densest populated parts of the planet with people from all walks of life. Basically, our first initial competition-winning idea for the dry line was to use the park itself. As the project evolved and a new leadership in the city came, it was decided to deal with the flooding at the edge of the water. So not to use the park as a kind of floodable zone, which meant that everything had to change and raise. And then, of course, in the short term, you end up seeing what was already a park transformed to a construction site for a period of several years. And I think that caused a lot of people to not look at the holistic picture, but see it as sort of
Their daily lives are being disrupted.
Exactly, and I think that's I think it's quite normal.
So when you were a kid growing up, you wanted to draw comics, not be an architect. How did that come about?
I have two siblings, a big sister and a little brother. My big sister was good at piano and singing. And I also had piano lessons, but I, of course, never matched whatever my sister was doing. So I kind of quickly. And I was good at drawing ever since, like, basically kindergarten. You know, I quickly got my 10,000 hours. So I was always better than the other kids at drawing. So I ended up drawing a lot and became very fascinated with graphic novels. And I thought that was going to be my career. But then after high school, there's no cartoon academy in Copenhagen. But the architecture school was part of the art academy. It doesn't feel like a huge choice because education is for free. So you can afford to waste a little bit of time figuring it out. So I thought I might as well get good at drawing the backgrounds, you know, like the landscapes and the buildings. And at some point I'll find my way back into graphic novels. But then, of course, I got fascinated with the architecture.
And who did you know when you were growing up who was an architect?
My family is entirely void of architects. My entire mother's side of the family are dentists, basically. Yeah, the only architect I knew by name when I started was Jørgen Utzon, the Danish architect of the Sydney Opera, who's kind of a national hero in Denmark and something we take great pride in. And that was definitely a building that I had noticed as one of the most incredible buildings I'd ever seen.
And you hadn't been to Sydney?
I finally came to Sydney after I had graduated as an architect.
It's interesting hearing you talk about the Sydney Opera House. You know, you're about to turn 50, and I wonder whether you think about what you want your legacy to be.
I would definitely hope sincerely that I will be remembered for work I haven't done yet. And it is possible, like Frank Lloyd Wright, he hadn't started designing on Falling Water, the Guggenheim in New York, or Johnson Wax Factory when he turned 60. And the other Frank, a lot of Frank Gehry's most significant work is also after his 60s, right? So,
and you have had a huge amount of success before 50, which is unusual given how long it takes to become an architect and to make buildings. Does it surprise you?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm incredibly grateful that I got to experience that. 2 years ago, I did a kind of bucket list. Because also, like, sometimes you don't really want to confess to the world what you really want because, you know, it makes you very naked. And then you can definitely be measured on your ability or not to get there, right? So I made a little bucket list. I would like to do a Philharmonic concert hall. I would like to do an opera house. I would like to do a national library. I'd like to do a national museum. And I'd like to do an airport. And also committing to say, actually, we're willing to overinvest, you know, my time and the right people's time and also resources in getting these kind of commissions. Because they're public commissions. You can only win them
in competition.
In fair competition. And just by confessing to myself and to the team that this is what we want. We're now actually doing the airport of Zurich. We're doing the Philharmonic in Prague. We're doing the opera of Nashville. We're doing the Natural History Museum of Beijing.
That's quite a list. Congratulations. That's amazing.
No, actually, like I regret that I didn't make that bucket list 25 years ago.
This sense of fun that lots of people say that you have, I'm assuming comes from your interest in drawing cartoons and being interested in comic strips and so on. You've also manifested it in your buildings, a ski slope on the side of a waste-to-energy plant and climbing frames and so on. Why are you interested in the relationship between those two things, architecture and fun?
I think this idea of fun, it is a deeper thing. It's really about enjoyment and it's about the enjoyment of life, because at the end of it, architecture is the art and science of accommodating life.
You've written and talked about hedonistic sustainability, which really interests me in the context of this project here in New York. Just explain what hedonistic sustainability means to you, but also the extent to which you think that you might be able to replicate what you have done here with regard to the challenges of climate change in other parts of the world?
So the first project we ever did was the Copenhagen Harbor Bath, that essentially extends the life of the city of Copenhagen into the port. And when we opened it, the Copenhageners were rushing into the water. They didn't have to drive their cars for hours to get to the beach. They could really literally jump in the port in the middle of the city. And it was kind of clear that a clean port is not only nice for the fish, it's amazing for the citizens. And we thought this is maybe a bigger idea.
Do you think, though, about countries that are really facing climate change? I mean, you know, Hurricane Sandy obviously was a manifestation of climate change. We're going to see situations like that more and more. We are already. But do you think that countries that are on the kind of front line of the change that is taking place deserve the kind of engagement that you're giving this city to?
Yeah, like I think if you have to essentially fortify your waterfront, or if you have to make your streets more permeable, and you can make them permeable by making them greener, you can make a city more walkable and more bikeable by making it greener. We're doing a project with Toyota called The Woven City, where we are actually proposing to reinterpret the typical city grid so that instead of making everything more or less dominated by the car, to say that only every third street has electric autonomous vehicles and pedestrians, more like a conventional street, mm-hmm. then every third street has personal mobility, more like a promenade for bikes, for personal e-scooters and for pedestrians. And then every third street is literally a park, a green park where you can walk. Hmm. You know, weaving together a city grid where you can actually get from anywhere to anywhere in an autonomous electric car or riding an e-scooter or walking through a park. So in a way, that city becomes more resilient because it's much more permeable, becomes more sustainable, and it becomes more enjoyable. And even in the extreme case, we're working with a startup company called Oceanics, where we're going to make the first case study, a city block in Busan in South Korea, for a floating city, in this case, a floating city block. There will be waterfront areas and there will be entire nations like the Maldives or entire cities like Miami Beach that will have to deal with flooding. And so if you, in a way, start turning the land into park and nature, and you start turning the water into the city, each generation has to somehow use the knowledge they have right now to do the best they can right now with the tools they had available and create, in a way, the next step for the future generations to step on so they can reach even higher and then the following can reach even higher.
Bjarke Engels, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the documentary The Cultural Frontline from the BBC World Service on the Manhattan Flood Project and the architect Bjarke Engels. I'm Razia Iqbal, and the producer was Corinna Jones.